So it's the Grouchy Club podcast. The Grouchy Club podcast. Me, John Fleming, her, Kate Copsley, our special guest, the guru of PR men, Matt Bukowski. We're in the Gilded Balloon bar, library bar, where there's lots of background noise, but I trust Apple not to pick it up.
Yes, and if you can't hear a bloody thing John is saying, it's because he insists on pointing the microphone away from him, despite all my excellent suggestions to the contrary.
So why is Mark Bukowski in Edinburgh? Mark Bukowski?
Do you know what? It's 4 years since I've actually been to the festival proper, and it's probably 7 years since I've actually ever worked anything. And someone said to me today, when did you first come to the Edinburgh Festival? And I thought back at it, and I thought, you know, it was 30 friggin' years ago.
30 years ago. So that was what, 80?
I think it was 87.
I think it was before that.
Yeah, more than that.
85, 86. Black Theatre Co-op. And then it was Tom Robinson, Hank Wangford, the famous Cowpat Flinging Challenge. And then it was Archaos, which less said the better. But it's quite interesting how...
Why the less said the better about Archaos?
Oh, no, because do you know what? I think you've got to be very careful. I was saying to somebody the other day, I've actually written a piece for the stage, and I thought, yeah, if you want me to write a piece to say... Oh, it's not what it used to be. I said, I refuse to say that. Edinburgh is still as vital, as interesting as it always has been to a generation who want to consume it. And the older the fart is to actually start being nostalgic about times gone by is failing to address there are millions of young people here forging relationships, taking vast quantities of drugs, drinking large amounts of alcohol, shagging into the early hours and building relationships and breaking things, and that is the point of it. And I think the saddest thing is that we can't get the traditional media and the noise of social media to focus on what still is some of the most energetic and visceral things on the face of the planet.
And that's why he's a top PR.
indeed. I mean, that's true, that all of that is true. And I one of the shortcomings, like John already is smirking. You see, I say something like shortcomings.
He's a comedian.
Shortcomings.
About John and myself's view of The Fringe is that it's very, very comedy skewed. It's totally comedy skewed. And comedy, I agree that there's always something new, there's always something interesting, and you're not going to know where that is unless you go and find it. But comedy has become very industrial.
Yeah.
And I think there is still wonderful there, but it's harder to find, and it doesn't get... I mean, television is very short-sighted, very narrow-minded, very, now especially, wants to play it safe. So the crazies and the weirdos and the wonderful, visceral... Fuck me, what's going to happen next performers that John and I love to ferret out and laud have a very hard time getting any kind of publicity.
But didn't you say you weren't going to talk to PRs because they were the downfall of The Fringe?
No, actually, it's not. The PRs are not the downfall of The Fringe. The agents are the downfall of The Fringe, because the industrialisation of comedy, it's true, has come through. Also, we could debate this, is that when I first came to the Edinburgh Festival as a boy child to promote God's Dog, who was still then a puppy, was that I remember going to one of the hotels on Princes Street to the official festival press centre, and it was a vast room full of the world's international press, and the focal point for the festival was clearly the international festival. What happened was, as a rise of the big three or four venues came up, and the industrialisation you talk of comedy, is that I think the great city fathers saw this as an opportunity to spend less money in the official festival under the days of Brian McMaster, where it became just such a poor... So there wasn't a symbiosis between the official and the fringe, and the fringe overtook it. And of course, by that time, there was an identity. And of course, we know, you know, the state of, you know, media now, that no one can afford to come up. The reason they can't afford to come up is because there's not enough news stories for them, because those who are going to be the big comics of the future will have most of the support from the agents who then pay the PRs. And curation, which you're pretty damn good at of telling us pointers, go and see that person, is what is needed. But I think, you know, the Fringe is getting, the Official is getting much fitter now.
Yes.
It's attracting more media to it. And I think that's where places like Summer Hall and whatever are doing some really interesting things. Make it more than just a sort of stand-up fiesta, you know, because, you know, it's not... I'm up here looking for this because we've got a big project to sort of talk about how we bring satire back in a television format. And we're looking for people here, not just comedians, but artists, graphic artists, poets and whatever, who can actually bring dangerous work back to it. Because if you think of dangerous comedy, you're not going to get a television career out of that.
Oh,
because
if you think of not just danger, but television, challenging, or even I pitched a series that John and I were wildly enthusiastic about. It was kind of like the good old days, but with weirdo comics, you know, all the crazies and the acts of got a bit of physicality to them and just left field stuff, and bring back some of those old acts like The Man Who Ate His Brain, these wonderful kind of vaudevillian, broad spectrum, crazy shows. And who was it at the time? I forget which channel was banging on about, yes, we want new, we want interesting, we want left field. So I went there with this, and they came back and said, love it, absolutely love it. It's absolutely fantastic. I think this just sounds hilarious, but nobody's going to commission it unless it's got names in it. Well, you go, well, how can there be names? And you
no, it's a sort of, it's a Kafkaesque problem being thrown at the sort of people. This is an extension area.
We want new.
Well, I caught up with somebody who I had not seen for years, and I remember him being lauded when I was working the festival as Terry Alderton. Now Terry Alderton was a great white hope. He was fantastic. He had Addison Cresswell as an agent. Addison was punching around town. What happened to that career? And yet I saw him in a stand-up in London and over the Establishment Club. I thought, this guy is more dangerous, more funny than I ever remember him. And still that physical comedy and that sort of hearing voices and whatever. Yeah. What happened to Terry Alderton? How did somebody who was was he a Perrier winner? Well, he was certainly nominated. Go from that, to being agentless virtually. You know.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, I think every time, like when Addison went, it's like, you know, it's like Game of Thrones when the king. You know, the king in the south is unexpectedly dethroned by death. Then whoever comes in to sit on the throne immediately beheads all the favourites, unless they're strong enough, of the king in the south, and brings in their own favourites. So whenever somebody in that kind of position goes, all the people that they brought on are like, well, he wasn't that good anyway, was he? Couldn't have been. And they bring in their own people, unless that person has made themselves kind of coup-proof. Like Michael McIntyre, who, nobody's going to get rid of Michael McIntyre because you may as well just burn your savings down. But it's...
he's much loved. I mean, it's not my brand of comment. And I remember you and I have a conversation about him.
Oh, I love Michael McIntyre.
You position a very good... argument for McIntyre, and it's not my brand of comedy, but actually people circle the wagons around that style of comedy, and truly epic in the same way. It's quite interesting because we flip back to the sort of Tarbuckian days of that was actually smashed apart in the early 80s, So maybe it's coming back to it. You know, I'm very keen to think about the politicisation of comedy this year, because we've had some tremendous events that is fodder for every satirist, should be.
And then you mentioned the establishment club, ...
Yes.
Why would that be?
Well, I mean, we helped to relaunch of the establishment club back in 2011 when Victor Lewis Smith and Keith Allen befriended Lynn Cook.
And this used to be in the 60s, there's a big satire club that Peter Cook started.
Yeah, in the Soho, and it was really the challenging, and it was where, you know, all those sort of doors of that age, and then it gradually, as they all got actually more famous and got grabbed by Hollywood, and the story of, Peter Cook, who was left behind in some ways and yet had funded, I think Lynn Cook's widow still owned a huge chunk of Private Eye, for example. And there all his acolytes went on to greater things, particularly in Hollywood, and then we moved away. We also need what we had at the time, what I had when I was launching shows here. You had some right-wing zealot who you could feed off, you know, Maura Knox and Mary Whitehouse. Of course, then they had the Lord Chamberlain. It was incredible to consider that actually there was an establishment body who would actually allow you to...
But now you've got the left-wing snowflake PC brigade.
So are you looking for right-wing talent for a TV channel?
Yeah, anything. I think some of the most interesting stuff is coming from the alt-right.
And then which channel?
If you think of things like Heat Street, which is now gone, and you think of things like The Canary, which is a very interesting model, because actually not only do you get paid a sum of money, but also if your article is popular, then you get a share of the revenue, which will cause people then create clickbait. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, both my kids, 21 and 23, you know, are obsessed by comedy. Absolutely obsessed by comedy. You know, because it's The Simpsons, it's Family Guy.
Yep.
You know, they pore over those sort of things. They're looking at Mock the Week. They're going onto YouTube. They're seeing clips and sort of stuff to remember to. It's a vibrant time. But of course, as we all know, developing 15 minutes of comedy or 5 minutes of gags and elongating that into a show, that's a huge thing. I saw Chiggy from PBJ, and we were talking about it and saying, do you still go to Edinburgh? She said, you see so many people with 5 or 10 minutes of brilliant material, but actually in their head, they're throwing it against the wall, and they die within a format like this because they haven't got half an hour or even an hour, but they're always thinking, what's next? Or, you know. Yep. So thank God things like Vine disappeared, because that was... You know, that was a horrible medium for the soundbite of comedy. It was a gag, you know, and people built up the series of gags. You know, they got some horrible misogynist people, you know, that came up through that, you know. So
which channel are you looking at?
Well, you're pushing me. Russia Today are quite happy to throw money into the ring. Don't forget, they gave Jonathan Pine that leverage. Yeah, that's how he started. So, and it doesn't, you know, people want to sort of throw in some Putin jokes, that's fine. If they, you know, there's no censorship here. But they want to see it, and it's with Victor Lewis Smith, who wants to produce a television programme, and the whole thing is the Establishment Club will be looking, we're not talking just about stand-ups, we're looking about satirists, we're looking about writers, we're looking about people within social media, we're talking about artists and whatever. How do we create something that is a visceral show?
What a smack in the face for UK broadcasting, if that's what it takes.
But how can UK broadcasting do that now? I mean, the BBC should be doing that, but they can't. Mm. The commercial channels are beholden to advertisers. So everything is a financial model at the moment that needs to be... You need to find money. So how do you develop that?
How are you finding these acts? Are you going to tour them or anything?
We're going to 7 cities to look at, but obviously it's done through social media. And those 7 cities is sort of like a point to generate both social and old media to give it traction. and then see what's out there. I mean, maybe there's nothing. Maybe people don't want to be involved. I don't know.
So you're putting shows on in these fine cities?
I don't think we're putting live shows. Just going in and saying, are you there? Come along. Show us what you got. Or even, you know, bring it together.
So you're doing
we're going back to Edinburgh while the festival's on.
You're doing audition-y type things?
Yeah, not audition, but let's see, you know, your audition tape, you know, what are you doing? So we're coming back here with Newcastle, Brighton, Bristol, or Manchester, all the usual places, see what's out there. But hopefully there is, because if there isn't, then it's not going to happen. But there is, you know, it needs to be. There was a very good programme, has been running on RT, the Sam Delaney Show. Which has been really good to, you know, stiff the likes of Nigel Farage and, you know, you name it, they've all been on it. Because every politician wants a soapbox to show off his funny side.
Well, Max Kaiser's a frustrated comedian.
Max Kaiser is a genius, actually. I mean, a really an interesting guy. I spent some time, funnily enough, when I first got involved with the initial days of the internet, one of the big Chinese company had actually bought up a channel that was putting in content. And one of the things was the Hollywood Stock Exchange, which Max Kaiser invented. So you could actually buy fantasy shares in films and in actors and whatever, and you know, it's the same as fantasy football in terms of soccer. It was so good that it got bought out by Sony, because that's why Matrix 4 never got funded, because the crowd of people on the internet saying this is absolute pants, and I think that, you know, so all the investors sort of ran away, so Sony took it out by bought it up and moved it away. So hence the power of corporate entertainment.
Yeah, but anyway, seeing all these acts, then they might end up in some programme and
it's a 30-minute show.
Well, you're really selling it well there, John.
30-minute show. 30-minute show.
It's been confrontation, so you can...
No, you're seeing all these acts, and they might well end up on some kind of show.
Well, he has to explain, doesn't he?
I do have to explain.
Interview technique. You should
okay.
try it.
But the idea is, are they out there? Do they want a platform? And if so, is one for them, and under the Establishment Club. And it's to reinvestigate the values of the Establishment Club.
And how do these people apply or whatever?
There's going to be a website. I should know far, so I can't. But I'm sure you can. It's that bit you say on YouTube.
Yep.
If you go down here.
Yeah.
But anyway, I can't do that.
No one ever reads that.
Yep. They do.
But you're a... What do you say about male doyen?
A doy. No, doyen is E-N, and doyen is E-N-N-E.
But I think in some ways, this is getting back to the underbelly of this. I mean, we're not particularly interested in anybody that's made it. We want to find the future Jonathan Pines.
I haven't made it.
Pardon? No, I've never made it.
Well, there we go. It's...
Well, I'm talking about comedians.
Cruel. Harsh, but fair.
But I mean, in terms of, you see, you know, you both have flown the flag for the interesting folk that perhaps wouldn't have got any traction.
White flag, admittedly.
Sorry?
A white flag.
But... No, I don't be self-deprecating. It's not important. But I think, you know, particularly those who have actually struggled without the sort of... I'm not sure. Have PR still got the muscle in Edinburgh now?
What they
do... It's noise now, isn't
what
it?
Yeah, it's kind of like, in my humble opinion...
Humble? Huh.
Is they create a kind of white noise. So what there is there's a kind of a like a smog blanket of PR guff, which lies between... acts in Edinburgh who've got enough money or are daft enough to throw away 2,000 for a PR, and then the ones without it. So it's not really that anybody would go and see, anyone with half a brain would go and see a show because a PR says it's good. But they, as I say, they kind of create this fog that makes it more difficult to see what's on the other side. And it definitely makes the people on the other side, I'm not saying below, but on the other side, feel that they need to stand on a PR's shoulders to get above the fog, which is tragically becoming more correct. Because now you've got all the little websites, you know, I failed my A-levels, but now I've got a website.com, who are reviewing. They love it when the PRs come and do the, you know, I'd love you to, I think you'd really get Johnny No Talent. You'd be just exactly the right person to review him. And they think, oh, how marvellous. And so they will, they might be swayed, but anyone with half a brain isn't. But they do create a funk. They're like a huge, great blob of sour cream on top of your nachos. So you don't get to see whether they've actually given you enough salsa and, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting because you know, I've spawned two interesting humans, one of as I said, both loving comedy, and every day both these little things in my life take the piss out of me every day, which is quite funny. And we were looking at the programme because my youngest is coming up this weekend. Youngest, 21 now. And I said, look, you decide what you want to go and see. So I gave him the Fringe Brogue. He said, what the hell is this? You know, he was looking after everything. And then he was thumbing through the Brogue. And he was in sort of absolute, sort of tearful raptures of laughter. He said, hear what they're saying about this. Hear what they're saying about that. She's reading through it, you know, the sort of guff, the marketing guff. And he knew one or two of the comedians, said, this doesn't represent what this bloke does, or this woman does. And he said, actually, I don't have to go to the festival. He said, I just read this brochure and get more laughs for reading the brochure.
Yeah.
You know, and I never looked through the brochure. I gave it, looked at it, and I thought, Jesus God, trade descriptions are.
I know.
If you were an estate agent, you'd be fined.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And they do, I mean, there's one particular comic who shall be nameless, Tom Steed. his PR, I saw him when he did his first show, it was fabulous. Saw the second show, first show, I said something along the lines of, I was very young and not very good, said he's so cool, he could be the answer to global warming. Hilarious.
Very good. Too good, Kate.
It's unbelievable. You could hire me, Mark. Yeah. Very cheap. Yeah. Now he was still, he then, I felt, started to believe his own publicity and turned into
a monster.
I mean, oh God, so far up himself he could not tunnel his way out with the help of the entire cast of The Great Escape,
allegedly,
and they were still using that quote 10 years later. I think I have to be, this year I saw him quite recently, we saw him do a Canadian thing and he was awfully good, so maybe he's on the turn, as they say. But no, the brochure is, it's,
yeah,
a,
but comics' egos are the most challenging because they're the most fragile of humans, really. A lot of them.
Can't stand the heat to get out of the kitchen.
Well, yes, I guess, but I mean, it's a sort of challenge of being not found funny, I guess, which.
Well, several of them are not funny.
True, we got that. But I think that it goes a long way. Where I think people can actually manage that to their advantage if you're in PR, to actually be, so the talent becomes dependent on mummy or daddy, and therefore they get paid accordingly, which is something I found very disturbing, because you just need to tell people the truth sometimes to keep them away from the Faustian devil, you know, who is handing out the contract daily for them to sign with blood, because fame is toxic.
There you are. So that's a PR telling you that you have to tell the truth. Is that unusual?